You're listening to the River East Church Podcast, a Jesus community for the world.
We'll see how this goes. I have my backup on my phone in case things go really bad, so don't worry about me. Good morning, everybody. As I hope some of you at least have heard by now, this fall, in just over 1 week, I will be going on sabbatical. So, in other words, I will be taking about 4 months away from my regular duties at River East, and I will be spending this time in a season of academic input, working on my master's degree over at CMU. So I just want to take this chance to say once again that I'm both very excited and very grateful for the opportunity. So today, for my last sermon of 2025, I want to take the time to do two things. I want to offer, once again, a kind of window into the work that I'll be doing at CMU this fall, specifically around the importance of narrative or narrative theology. But also, since today we're outside and we're acknowledging the season of creation that we find ourselves in, I want to talk about narrative through the lens of the climate crisis. To dive in, I want to start by sharing two stories that came out of our youth ministry from this past year. So, first story. This past December, just before Christmas, I was standing in front of the youth at a regular Dungeons & Dragons night. Now, if you're not familiar, Dungeons & Dragons, or D&D for short, is a collaborative storytelling game. What unfolds at the table is really only limited by the player's imaginations and the roll of some dice. So before our D&D nights, I often stand up at the beginning and I explore a quick story from the real world. In D&D, our imaginations shape the stories we tell, but in real life, it also works the other way around. The stories we tell shape our imaginations. The stories we tell inform what we believe is actually possible in real life. So on that particular day, I was testing something out with the youth. I was naming a few problematic types of stories that I kept on noticing in my own, like, social media feeds. Common ways of narrating what's going on in the world that I didn't think were actually true. And I thought they might be impoverishing our imaginations. These are all stories that boil down to things like this. Winning is everything. I don't think that's true. Violence brings order out of chaos. I don't think that's true either. Religion or politics are all about being correct. I don't think that's true either. And up until that point, it was a pretty easy conversation. The youth seemed to agree with me that yes, winning isn't everything. There are better ways to engage with life. But then I offered another problematic narrative that I kept on seeing that at least I thought was totally false. Today is one of the worst times to be alive. And I can still see in my mind's eye the disagreement in some of those teenagers' faces. I got pushback from more than one person. Isn't that one true? Isn't now one of the worst times to be alive? Haven't you seen the news? Everything's falling apart. If the alt-right doesn't ruin everything tomorrow, quote, the climate crisis will kill all of us in the next 20 years. So for many of Gen Alpha, the overarching narrative that today is one of the worst times to be alive, at least for some of them, that rang true. Second story, this time from March. I had been asked to speak at the Consider the Lilies gathering, which is hosted by Arosha, Manitoba each year. And I was specifically asked to share about young people and their experience of the climate crisis. And so to prepare for that, I decided to set aside a youth event and just ask them. So after a chaotic night out bowling just down the road and offering them all manners of snacks, we sat down as a group in the church basement, and I had prepared a bunch of questions on a PowerPoint just to pick their brains and start a conversation. These were questions like, what's it like to be in your generation when society faces climate crisis? What do they talk about in school these days regarding the climate? How often do you think about climate change, and has it affected your behavior? And I concluded with this question. Some people have said the climate crisis is just another name for a spirituality crisis. What do you think of that? Now, that discussion was really helpful for me because several themes came to the surface right away. For instance, all of these youth were aware of the climate crisis, that it was serious and life-changing, and that the stakes were high. That was obvious to them. And yet, the majority of them felt that there was nothing they could do about it, that they could choose to live their entire life as a kind of eco-hermit, off the grid, and that life of heroic effort would be instantly deleted by Coca-Cola factories in just 2 minutes. So many of them confessed that they try not to think about it. And I really can't blame them. The topic is big and complicated and stressful. What else can you do but just be overwhelmed? And so as the conversation kept going that evening, eventually a mood of gallows humor descended on the group. And my question of spirituality, the suggestion that the climate crisis was another name for a deeper spiritual crisis, that didn't make sense to them at all. And maybe it doesn't for you either. For them, the word spirituality was totally divorced from big social topics like this. And it took quite a bit of conversation before they could even make sense of my question, never mind if they agreed with it or not. Now, those two moments I've recently had with Gen Alpha, the sense that this is the worst time to be alive, and that spirituality doesn't seem connected to matters of collective action, these are two data points in a larger pattern I've been seeing over these years. A pattern that I think is saying we are all living in a crisis of narrative. Simply put, our collective stories about who we are as people, what we're all doing here on Earth, and where this is all headed, you know, old stories that used to be held in the realm of spirituality, those stories have become fractured, questioned, and contested. And let me be honest, it's done that for good reasons. As a society, we now have a growing awareness that our past, it's not squeaky clean. Colonization, resource extraction, the role the church has played in all of those things and more. This awareness has shaped many people's understandings of where we've come from and how much allegiance we should offer our spiritual ancestors. But just as our history is being called into question, our sense of the future has as well. The optimism of just a few decades ago, of progress and growth and prosperity and peace, well, that's pretty hard to hold on to these days. We all look with horror at the violence being done overseas or just at our doorstep. We all smelled the smoke this summer. How can we not call the future into question? Again, there are some really good reasons for this line of questioning, but there's also a cost. With both the past and the future now problematized, we as a society have not yet figured out how to tell a coherent story of what we are doing here together. Instead, it seems to have been replaced by a bottomless torrent of bite-sized, point-form, algorithmically driven content that's usually designed to make us upset. And that, in turn, affects our imaginations, what we think is possible. How could it not? And so today, I believe we all find ourselves caught in a narrative drought. Or maybe it's better to say we're adrift in a narrative ocean. Saltwater stories all around us, but so little to actually drink. I think this affects us all, but especially, I'm thinking it's affecting our young people. This is the worst time to be alive. Like, what does one do with that? I've been thinking about that a lot, and I don't have a clean or simple answer. It's part of why I'm going back to school. But as I was thinking about my words for this morning, the story of the disciples walking to Emmaus came to mind. Now, maybe that's because we've already talked about the story twice this year. I am aware. I am going to do it again, though. I wonder what it would have been like to be Cleopas and his unnamed companion on the road that day. We often refer to them as disciples on the road to Emmaus, but I wonder if that's how they would have identified at that point. Because if I were them, I'd be having an identity crisis. Their whole world had just shattered. As Jews, they would have been well steeped in the stories of their past. They had just been to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, the ritual recounting how God redeemed their people from the clutches of empire so many centuries ago. They came from a long-standing tradition proclaiming that God acted powerfully in history, and that same God acts in our lives today. And so, when Jesus of Nazareth came on the scene, when the Jewish people were once again experiencing oppression under the Roman Empire, and when Jesus began to travel and preach and heal the sick and exorcise demons and name that God's kingdom is at hand, for Cleopas and his friend, this looked like the fulfillment of their ancient Jewish expectations, their ancient narrative of a coming Messiah. As they themselves said on the road, they had hoped Jesus would redeem Israel and set her free from the Romans. They had hoped Jesus was the kind of political Messiah God would use to rescue them and usher in an era of freedom. And on that weekend, the future looked so promising, right? It was Passover, where everyone who's anyone was in Jerusalem. Multitudes had gathered where Jesus had entered into the city. They had laid down their cloaks and waved palm branches, singing, "Blessed is the King who has come in the name of the Lord." This was the type of welcome reserved for emperors. And so the city was just vibrating with anticipation. What would Jesus, their king, do next? How little did they know? They had so much hope. And then Jesus was betrayed by one of his own. He was arrested in the middle of the night. He was tried in a kangaroo court and sentenced to execution by the next day. Like, you have to wonder, what would it be like for these two, seeing, probably firsthand, Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem, believing God was bringing real, tangible changes to their lives imminently? Then you go and you find lodging for the night, you settle in for the Passover meal with your family, you go to sleep. I imagine it feels a bit like Christmas Eve. And then you wake up the next day and hear by word of mouth that their Savior was now hanging on a cross on the outskirts of town, crucified by the Romans. And so in one fell swoop, the past and the future came crashing down for these disciples. What did Jesus' death mean for their sense of God's saving action in the past and today? What did his missing body mean for their movement? And what does it mean for the future that such a promising Messiah could be snuffed out and disappear just like that? What do you do when your stories fall apart? Thus, the pair walk home from Jerusalem to Emmaus. They're processing these things out loud with each other. And the text goes out of its way to say that they were sad. I wonder if that was an understatement. But then another traveler catches up with them on the road, overhears them, and asks what they're talking about. And Cleopas is stunned. How can someone be so clueless, so blissfully unaware of everything that just took place over the weekend? So they explain to the stranger what has occurred and how their past and their future have now imploded. And what does the stranger do after hearing this? According to a different translation, he says, "You fools." I'll be honest, I would have preferred a more empathetic response there. But the stranger presses on. "Don't you see that something bigger is going on here?" And then he proceeds, for the rest of the walk, to take them through their own sacred stories and show them a different way of understanding them, a deeper way of narrating what had just happened that weekend. And of course, if we had kept reading, Cleopas and his friend would soon discover that the stranger was in fact Jesus, the risen Christ, there in their midst, though they had not recognized him. The story concludes with a dramatic flair. As they realize that the stranger is Jesus, he vanishes from their sight. And they are left reflecting, "Weren't our hearts on fire when he spoke to us along the road and when he explained the scriptures for us?" Or maybe in other words, we could say, "Didn't we feel ourselves come alive when Christ offered this deeper alternative story?" Friends, I'm becoming increasingly convinced that the church has something really important to do today, particularly in the face of the climate crisis. Namely, I think the church needs to relearn how to tell deeper stories for our time. And I think the Road to Emmaus text offers just two reminders of how that can be done. First, and for me, by far the most challenging, in resurrection, God has broken open the disciples' assumptions about what the future holds. God offers a different glimpse of an unexpected, deeper reality, where God can interrupt death and then bend it toward justice and transformation and shalom. And as such, I think we are called to be open to that kind of interruption as well. Now, the reason I say this is challenging is because that kind of openness to interruption, that can be easily confused for just a limp optimism. It can look like passively waiting for God to swoop in and fix all of our problems. I'm pretty sure it doesn't work that way. For me, at least, openness isn't a naive optimism, but rather the practice of resisting easy cynicism, of releasing bleak certainty over what the future must hold, and laying it in Christ's pierced hands instead. In place of certainty, openness to resurrection gives us space for a different kind of imagination to take hold of us, which might lead to different ways of being and acting in the world. And this leads directly to the second point. The disciples on the Emmaus Road were alongside the resurrected Christ, right there beside them. They just didn't know it. I think this invites us to ask, where are the stories of how God is already at work in the world around us? Stories that too often get lost in the torrent of noise. I want to illustrate what I mean by that by concluding with a story, one last one from the youth group this year. So at the beginning of the sermon, I mentioned that some of the youth at the D&D group, they were convinced that today is the worst time to be alive. Well, 2 weeks after that discussion, either by coincidence or by providence, depending how you tell the story, I became exposed to the work of an Australian journalist named Angus Hervey. You heard of this guy? Oh dear. Hervey had become frustrated with the way that news algorithms are always reactive. Something happens suddenly and unexpectedly, and then that becomes the story that gets reported. It's a reaction. And usually, things that happen suddenly and unexpectedly aren't good, right? Good things, by contrast, usually take a long time. And so Hervey started a nonprofit organization called Fix the News, which is entirely dedicated to telling stories of long-term change for the better, stories that typical news algorithms would otherwise never cover. So with Fix the News firmly in hand, I stood before the D&D tables once again, as I always do, to tell them a story from the real world. And I began by saying this. I believe God is the author of life and harmony. And so any project, whether it's run by a church or not, if the work contributes to life and harmony, I trust that they are participating in the work of God in the world around us. And then to illustrate how God might be at work in the world around us, I read them summaries of about a dozen headlines of sustained, positive, impactful work that people all over the world are doing to address the climate crisis. For example, in 2024, 23 species were taken off the endangered list. The largest desert greening project in human history completed its first stage this year, and it was 46 years in the making. Did you know that Amazon deforestation fell by half in 2024, and Brazil is beginning a 35-year reforestation program? Did you know that today, right now, all of us are living in the midst of a renewable energy revolution? Wind and solar combined accounted for only 1% of global energy output in the year 2005, and this year it will be 20%, and that switch is predicted to be exponential. And related to that, there are signs that China's oil consumption will peak for all of history this year in 2025, several years ahead of schedule, and with it, possibly the historical peak of human-generated and air pollution. Possibly. My friends, the sense of hope that I felt in the room as I offered these simple stories to the youth, It was like that glass of water for a thirsty traveler who is surviving a narrative drought. I would literally finish a headline, and they would ask for another one. A few weeks later, two students told me that they used Fix the News and these positive stories of long-term change. They used those stories in their own school projects because it offered an alternative, hopeful narrative in a time when they so desperately needed it. The stories we tell shape our imaginations, which in turn shapes our actions. And the church confesses that God, whose other name is love, God is at work in the world today, transforming us into a more holy and human shape such that we all might join in and participate in this peace. Those stories of transformation are the stories the world desperately needs to hear today. And it's for that reason that I believe that actually, weirdly, now might actually be the church's time to shine. May we be up to that task. Amen.
Thanks for listening to the River East Church podcast, the Jesus community for the world. We are an Anabaptist church pursuing wisdom, prophecy, and compassion here in Winnipeg, Manitoba. If you'd like to learn more about us, you can find us online at rivereastchurch.ca. We hope you join us for next time, and until then, may grace and peace be with you.